this is a little different event than just the regular workshops we've been doing. We have some guests with us today, and we're opening it up to everybody in the John Jay community. We're recording today, so that's so others can benefit from the conversation we're having, and also some of our friends from Libraries Without Borders may share that in the future. So as a heads up, that's why cameras are rolling. And since I see there are folks who are in the workshop and maybe some others popping in, so I'll just do an intro, and then I'll introduce the guests that we have with us today, and then I'll hand it off to them, if that sounds right. So if anybody needs context, this guest speaker event is part of a 10-week workshop called Humanities in Action at John Jay College. It's a workshop for humanities students, so that's students in four majors here. It's English, global history, philosophy, and humanities and justice, our interdisciplinary humanities major. And the idea of the workshop is to link what we're doing in our majors with some real world issues and also future career paths. So it's kind of outward facing. And so we're really excited to speak with a few guest speakers. We have a mini guest speaker series, and this is our first one, and hear a bit about the work that you're doing. Today with us, we have folks from Libraries Without Borders, and I want to especially thank Professor Sarah McDonald, who helped facilitate these relationships so that we can have this conversation today. I'll introduce the group, but I'll let Catherine also dig in further. Libraries Without Borders, it's a non-governmental organization that's active internationally, but also in different parts of the United States. And they help build cultural spaces, learning spaces, a range of different spaces in communities that are experiencing crisis or suffering different sorts of ongoing precarity. And we're talking today especially about their work in Puerto Rico and in Loíza, Puerto Rico, which I think has some history going back to maybe Hurricane Maria in 2017, but we can hear a bit more. And on the call right now, maybe you can raise your hand to say hello. We have Catherine Trujillo, who's the Director of Education / Deputy Director at Libraries Without Borders in the U.S. And we also have Alex Alderondo, there you are, who's the manager of Project Overcome in Puerto Rico. And depending on connectivity, I think we may have one other person jumping on, but we'll see. I'm very excited to, we're all excited to speak with you today and hear a little more about the work that you're doing. Can we give them all like a big Zoom virtual clap welcome? And, yeah, thank you. Yay. Thank you for coming. So yes, all the hand emojis leap up. So I'll hand off to Catherine. Is that all right? And you can tell us a bit more about Libraries Without Borders.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Elliot, for the warm introduction and Sarah for the invitation. Just, you know, to reintroduce myself, I'm Kat Trujillo. My full name is Catherine, but please always call me Kat because I won't. Catherine sounds like someone else. I'm the Deputy Director and Director of Education at Libraries Without Borders. And as Elliot mentioned, we're an international nonprofit. We're actually the U.S. branch of Bibliothèques Sans Frontières. And our work focuses, at least in the U.S., a lot on bridging the digital divide, particularly in places like Detroit, Oakland, and Puerto Rico in Loíza, which we'll go into greater detail in the second part of the discussion. As Elliot mentioned, we've been working in Puerto Rico pretty much since after Hurricane Maria. In 2018, I was the person on our three-person team at the time that went to Puerto Rico essentially to meet with a number of humanitarian organizations that are, you know, parent organization, Bibliothèques Sans Frontières, worked with in Jordan and Iraq. They, you know, because of all of the damage that that was caused in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. There were a number of international NGOs on the island, and so they'd reached out to us to ask if it might be possible to set up a pop-up learning space on the island or multiple places, particularly because there had been so many schools that closed or that were damaged, and there wasn't really a clear timeline on when some of those schools would reopen. And it turns out some of them never reopened. So really, I was there almost on a like exploratory fact-finding mission more than anything. And it was during that trip in 2018 that I met Moreno, who isn't on the call at the moment, but hopefully we'll get a chance to introduce you to him. He's the project coordinator on the island who's overseeing our current efforts. I met him in 2018, and he immediately just, his whole heart was just pouring with love for this place that I had never heard of before, called Loisa. And he had been working there in many different capacities, but the one that he was able to talk more expansively about was his role at the Boys and Girls Club. And through that, we visited the Boys and Girls Club. We also just, it seemed like everywhere we went, Moreno knew someone. And I just, you know, I found love. I saw what he saw. At the same time, I saw also what he saw, but a lot of, you know, the impact of the hurricane, but also existing poverty. There's a lot of inequality. Loisa is, there's, you know, it's not a coincidence that it's a primarily like Black population. They face a lot of discrimination in a number of ways. But, you know, it's such a culturally rich place and so vibrant, just so alive. And the people were lovely. The food's amazing. I just fell in love. And I saw that, you know, there were schools that looked like they were not going to reopen. There were buildings. I mean, at the time, it was just still chaos in many ways. But as is the reality in the nonprofit world, if you don't have money, you can't make anything happen. So sadly, at that point in time, we didn't have any funding to make anything happen. So leveraging a lot of our connections, mainly friends I met when I was there, and folks that worked in, you know, disaster response work, we got our pop-up library and multimedia center, which is called the Ideas Box, from Detroit to Puerto Rico. And we were able to use that in two communities, actually, Loisa and La Perla, which is a community that's on the outskirts of Old San Juan. And we ran two programs where we had bomba y plena, so dance and music, arts. We had reading, like literacy activities, and a number of other activities for folks of all ages, but mainly focused on children or school-age children. And that all happened, again, with zero money. We want, you know, from that moment on, I was really committed to trying to, you know, keep some kind of presence in Puerto Rico, because there was obviously interest, like community members, especially in Loisa, were just like, this is amazing. We love the Ideas Box. Like, you know, there were so many ideas that were brewing from that initial foray into working on the island that I knew, you know, there's got to be something that we can make happen. You know, we had some corporate funders like Sony that were interested in giving us support. But again, these were like very one-off, not very systematic, I would say. There was like, oh, okay, we'll give you a little bit of this, we'll give you that. And we couldn't really build on these one-off efforts. And we needed to have a major investment in order to give our efforts on the island a chance and really like build on what so many community members had shared with us as their priorities. So luckily, you know, despite having these one-off efforts, or I think because we didn't, you know, just say, okay, there's no money, we're not gonna do anything. We kept trying to make do with what we had. We were able to host summer camps and a number of other events, especially during COVID-19. We distributed laptops and we worked, and I say we, but we're working like through partners. Link Puerto Rico is one of our local nonprofit partners, and set up connectivity in one of the community centers that I'd you know, met with in 2018, and we continuously kept that relationship going in order for kids to participate in remote virtual learning during COVID. And it was through that, or through all of those different efforts, that we were able to be competitive for a National Science Foundation grant that was focused specifically on digital inclusion and connecting the unconnected. And we applied for it. We received it earlier this year. We were notified. It's the largest federal grant our organization has received to date, which I'm very proud of, because we went from having $0 to all the dollars. And we're able to hire folks to really do the work that needed to be done. Yeah, that's how I'm very proud of that, because we really did go from, I don't know if I can even like afford to like get food during my trip, to we have two staff members on the island, and one of whom, Alex, is here. And at this point, I really just want to pass it over to Alex, because he's there, he's on the ground, he's doing the work. And he can share his insights on, you know, everything that he's been present for in terms of this year. And Alex, I think I'll pass it over to you now.
Good afternoon. So I am the newest member of the team. I've been brought in to assist Moreno with the running of the show down here and help manage the project. I initially came from working with the Agile Learning Centers Network, pretty much a network of self-managed and self-incubated, self-directed learning communities that use agile tools to leverage this type of learning very efficiently. And that is framed in intentional culture creation. The combination of those three elements makes for an explosive and really amazing setting for learning to happen for people of all ages. And so I come from that background, having helped many communities in several countries get established and get going, and also as trainer of the facilitators in these centers. And Moreno is one of the individuals that went through these trainings with me. I've known him for many years, and as he landed the opportunity of working with Libraries Without Borders, he was like, hey man, I want to introduce some of these tools and practices into the work that we're doing, and maybe you can help me. So I've been helping him ever since. But then recently the opportunity came up, you know, for me to join them to help manage the project. And we're currently in the process of establishing three community centers in the town of Loíza, where we will just equip these spaces with top technology and connectivity, and also design the space with the tools and practices and the culture of the Agile Learning Centers in mind, in order to facilitate the process of individuals from these communities to get going with really efficient and like simply awesome like ways like of connecting with their desires, with their gifts, with their powers, and then creating projects that help them feel like fulfilled because they're doing, you know, their ikigai, right? Like what they're passionate about, but that also has a profound and long-term impact on their society, on their direct communities. Because as Kat mentioned, this is very, very underserved communities with a lot of like violence, drugs, and different social problems that make it really hard to live there and to stay there. These youth are extremely talented and passionate in such a wide variety of skills and areas that it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So we are trying to, you know, create spaces for really authentic and powerful learning to happen, and for like through the connectivity, develop digital literacy and increase levels of employment, health, and education in Loíza, right? So we're having like these three hubs as the pilot program, but our vision goes way beyond and trying to create a concept that is called Barrios Ágiles, like agile neighborhoods, where we just use this technology, these tools, these practices, this culture of collaboration and authenticity to just do a quantum leap into a different paradigm of like how we relate, how we learn, how we work, how we collaborate. And just create visions of the society we want to live in that are actually feasible and translatable to concrete results. I'm going to shut up now. I could keep going for hours about this. I'm really passionate about it and very like honored to be invited to the class and to the team at Libraries Without Borders.
That's great. Thank you so much. Thank you. I want to give a chance for students here to ask questions and make connections between, you know, what we're doing in humanities and the sort of work that y'all are doing. I wonder, can we get a little bit of day to day, like with Ideas Box, for example, when you rolled it out on the ground, or with agile learning, like what's a day to day? What are the activities like day to day in using the Ideas Box or doing an agile learning project? What are people doing? What are the interactions like? What's the setting like? You know, if you could paint a little picture for us like that, on the ground picture.
Alex, I wonder if you want to jump in and talk about the use of Agile.
Sure. We are still at a stage where we haven't like fully deployed the project. We're still like setting the spaces and all that. How that would look is that, let's say, in one of our main community center, we would have there any possible tool or the means to get them, any possible tool that anybody would need to get their idea going and to incubate their project, to prototype. And not just in the STEM way, like just prototype and make things, just really like getting the ideas tested and bounced off of different people so they can get it going. So one, to give you a little bit more like concrete response to your question, people would get in on a Monday morning afternoon, like if this was a afternoon program, I guess the space will be available from 3 p.m 4 p.m on until 9 p.m or something like that. So people will get in and set the week, and we would have shared collaboration boards that make this really important thing, make the feedback visible constantly. So it's totally centralized. We call it a Kanban board. That's one of the tools. So it basically makes the work that we're doing and the intentions that we're sharing visible for everybody. And then it creates a workflow that's visible and that allows us to start breaking this huge idea of creating my own like ecological vegan food truck or whatever it is into smaller, digestible, achievable chunks, like tasks that we would then get going. And then I have my own board, and we have the collective board, and there I would have like a row where I would then say, okay, so today or this week, my intentions are to get like the physical design of the like food truck going, get like a preliminary menu and so on and so forth. They would share, everybody would share, right? And we would go off to do our own thing. And in that process of like the scrum, we would also like coordinate with each other of like, okay, who needs help with what? Who's collaborated with me? Am I going to need a specific tool to do that, or a website, or some guidance to get to the next level, and so on? Before we get into the like meat of stuff in terms of work, we would also connect at like a very personal level, like through games or through like checking in. And create, that's the intentional culture element of it, where we create the social field that would allow for really fluid and like joyful work to happen. So we take care of that first, then we get to the work, right? We go on our own to do our own like, tasks or things that we established. And then towards the end, we would always, on a daily, weekly, bi-weekly, and monthly basis, create short agile meetings to reflect on what's happening, to through the visible feedback of these tools that are displayed in the space, see where things are getting stuck, where things are really just going at it like light speed. And then where other people, like we do this cross-pollination thing, where other people will see what you're doing that's working well, like get a little bit of that juice, right? And get it going on my end, or then like also prompt each other to get things moving if something is stuck. And there's a disparity between the intentions that you're saying and the actual actions, or how that translates into behaviors, you know, on a day-to-day basis. And then ending also with like, let's say a gratitude circle. So once we get things like the logistical, practical aspects of things like out of the way, and we know how to continue moving forward in the next iteration of this cycle of work and of play, then we just sit down, wind down, connect again, create this culture of gratitude as well, and then move on. So these agile cycles are based on like intention, creation, reflection, and sharing. We call it learning 2.0, where we don't really create a briefcase of tools and knowledge and keep it to myself all the way through my career. We keep our briefcase open for people to see what we're doing, what's working, what's not, and then really collaborate. And that cycle is like ongoing. And these short cycles allow for us to be very practical and efficient, but also weed out the many things that we do often in collectives or in like organizations, works, families, that take a lot of time and like mental and emotional energy out of the work that we say we want to do.
Thank you for that. I want to eat in that food truck when it gets finished. That's really great. Yeah, it's a really interesting, it's an amazing process on a skills level of getting it done, and on a content level, probably the types of projects that people would come up with and that you'd want to execute. I see Eleanor has a hand. I want to say, Kat, did you want to weigh in on anything or give any other context?
No, as I said, Alex and Moreno are the experts on what's actually happening on the ground. So couldn't have said it better myself.
Sure. But okay, let me take, Eleanor has a hand. Go ahead.
I do have a question. So how long has this sort of collaboration been a thing? Was it like it started from just one person that wanted to change, you know, the community and stuff? Or is it like a collaboration effort with a bunch of people and they have this one singular goal? And was it covered over the span of years or what?
I can jump in. So definitely the reason that Luisa was on my radar at all was because of Moreno, having, you know, the opportunity to meet him, put, Luisa on the map for me, and cultivating that relationship over time, even when we didn't necessarily have funding or there wasn't, an opportunity to build a specific program, that relationship with one person was foundational, but it also opened doors. And Moreno was very generous about introducing myself and by extension, the team of Libraries Without Borders to other organizations, community leaders, and folks that were interested in leveraging the tools and training that Libraries Without Borders is known for in Loíza. So he really opened those doors, made those connections, and helped us grow our network. Truly not just in Loíza, across the island. And it was through those relationships, in addition to having the opportunity to meet community leaders on my own, that we were able to bring folks together with this National Science Foundation grant. So now we are working very closely with a number of community leaders that are getting trained on how to serve as facilitators of the Agile methodology that Alex was talking about, in addition to working with the mayor's office in Loíza and other nonprofits, some of which focus on diversity and inclusion, particularly for people with disabilities. Some of them are religious groups. Some of them are just like they do public health or education. So this really enabled us to be more collaborative because the funding enables us to pay people for the work that they do. In many cases, people were doing work for free, and that's not sustainable and that's not right. So I think this opportunity really helped us solidify the collaborations that were kind of brewing, percolating for some time.
Just the way that you described the sort of organic relationship between the relationships people have on the ground in different places, the projects they see that are possible, and then figuring out how to formalize that, like turn the potential for something in Loíza into a national scale National Science Foundation grant. That's a whole set of of skills and capacities that could be really challenging.
Yeah, and a lot of it has just been, to be honest, like uplifting the work of folks that, you know, Moreno has been working in the community for ages. Alex has been doing this stuff for ages. There are a number of other community leaders that I was aware of who, you know, were working in different capacities in Loíza that we finally are able to, you know, bring together again because I think they were already doing this kind of work, and this just facilitates greater collaboration, which allows everyone to expand and amplify their efforts.
I have a educational paths question for you, but I see Adriana in the chat with a clarifying question. So Libraries Without Borders is a branch of Bibliothèque Sans Frontières.
We're the U.S. office. I think I used the term branch, and that's what we use on our website, but we're separate. We're financially, legally independent, but we share tools. We share board members. We share a number of different things, but we're a separate organization entirely.
Cool. Thanks for that clarification.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, other question, shifting a little bit, right? We're in a workshop, we've got probably a mix of students in the room. There's folks doing philosophy, global history, there's literary critics, aspiring literary critics in the room. So I wonder if you could say a bit about like what are the different educational paths that lead people to Libraries Without Borders or that type of, you know, NGOs like Libraries Without Borders? And if it's not too, you know, if you'd like, you could share a little bit about your path too. Like, what was your trajectory to doing this kind of work now?
No, I think we all kind of stumbled into this work. Like, I certainly didn't know that an organization like Libraries Without Borders existed, or that I would even have the ability to do the work that I have now. Like, maybe that was me having like a myopic view of what's possible and what careers exist, but I just didn't know. So I was you know, on the path to becoming a foreign service officer. I went to diplomacy school. I got like a master's of law in conflict studies. So I was like going to, you know, work at the UN or like at the Hague to like, you know, prosecuting international like criminals. And then I started to do that kind of work and I really hated it. It made me very miserable. It was very draining. And I circled back to the things that I used to do for, you know, as my extracurriculars, like for fun. What were the things that when, even when I had, you know, so many papers due and a test, that I still made time to go to like this meeting or to volunteer and do this. And they were all related to education and they were all related to working in communities that resembled the one I grew up in, right? So I grew up in South Central LA, very under-resourced, very, there's, you know, there's very, so many parallels between where I grew up and Louisa. So I was drawn to that and I kind of was able to find Libraries Without Borders and live out, you know, the all of the things that I'd been doing and get paid for it as well. So that was my path. And I know that in speaking to other folks on our team, they're like we've hired two of our interns and one of them is a poli-sci major. The other one was an anthropology major whose parents made her also like double major or minor in business because she needed to do something practical. And, you know, it turns out the anthropology major very useful for the work that we do. And she's doing finance at a nonprofit that focuses on, you know, promoting access to information. Sarah, our current ED is, or was a history major. So we're all over the place. Be practical. I can talk about this for ages. I really hate that because I think that what matters is the skills you learn. Like, can you think critically? Can you, are you hardworking? Are you like, being able to leverage your strengths regardless of what your field of study is more important than anything else, right? Cause I could say like, I took AP calculus and passed that test. I don't remember a damn thing about that at all. It just did not resonate with me, but I was on this path where I was told that like, you must take all the APs in the world because that will position you for this and that positions you for this. And it's like, no, it didn't at all. At least in my case, it was not relevant. I could go on. Alex, I don't know if you want to chime in about the educational path that you took to get here. I feel like it's a similar circuitous route, maybe.
I started laughing when the question came up. And you don't want to get me started with education. I think, what year are you guys? Like junior, sophomore, senior, like what?
I'm a senior.
Okay, senior, junior, so like a good mix. I believe the age of you study a career and you specialize in it and you work on it is long gone. And in addition to the things that Kat was saying about, you know, that you need to be practical and you need to like be hardworking and you need to have a good heart, you need to be happy, and you need to understand that you must have healthy limits to do whatever it is that you want to do. I find it so sad when I see people that are extremely successful and pretty affluent, but they're just miserable human beings. We won't take anything, like even the fame. Like I studied education. I did a bachelor's in liberal arts with a concentration in humanities. And then I went on to do a master's in education. And I even applied for a PhD in cognitive neuroscience because I felt passionate about it. Luckily, I didn't get in because that would have like just set me in a different path. But I have worked for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, working with people with disabilities and assisting with them getting the services that they deserve for being citizens, right? I've worked as a Boston Public School teacher teaching elementary school. I have worked as a university. I am studying to be a death doula. And I also work at a farm to just create sustainable food projects. So I believe that very few people will actually study something in which they will work and they will make a lifelong career out of it. Very few people. So connect with your gifts, with your talents, with your passions, with what really fires you up, and you would not bother even doing it for free. And then manifest the opportunity to work and create wealth and value and that human value, right? Like an impact in the world through that. Yeah. Just way beyond the practical stuff, really, just to, and how I literally stumbled onto this project and this job, not randomly, because I don't believe in randomness, but I literally manifested. Like, I was like, okay, the skills and passions that I have are like, they're way beyond my time. And I have been waiting for about 5 years for something like this to come up. I'm like, the time will come where I was actually doing this work and not getting paid. And then staff were like, no, like, you really gotta, like, what you're doing is really important. So yeah, those would be my two cents on this topic.
Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that too, both of you. Some of the things we'll be doing in this workshop are really nitty gritty practical. Like, let's look at some possible paths and so on that we might follow. But also parts of it are conceptual, just like this. Like, what's the relationship between our values and the sort of questions we're interested in and the things that move us about studying humanities, and what sort of paths can that lead us on? So I really thank you for that. Since we talked about manifesting, then we're moving into the big picture question. So I had one other big picture question, and then maybe open it up again if any other students. I don't want to keep just throwing questions back and forth. But could you speak a bit on what sorts of, how to phrase this exactly? What sorts of humanities questions or issues, like historical issues, philosophical issues, cultural issues that you feel that you're grappling with through this type of work or through the mission of Libraries Without Borders? I think that's something we're all thinking about. How does my philosophical question that I enjoy grappling with in my coursework, how am I going to grapple with that same question in some field that I go into? So I wonder if you could speak on that.
I can jump in. One of the big issues, one of the many big issues that our team grapples with, and that I think is a source of, no, I know is a source of tension between our office and the international headquarters, is the language that we use to talk about the communities that we work with, right? So I think there's a different paradigm that's used when you're in international development, or, you know, working in like protracted humanitarian emergencies. The use of things like vulnerable or precarity, or, you know, all of those terms, underserved versus under-resourced, even just like how we talk about who we work with or who we serve. That is a huge source of tension that I think is born out of the fact that a lot of folks on our team are really educated, have taken a lot of like philosophy, but are also like super social justice oriented and are always pushing back. And like, well, it's not that folks are vulnerable. It's not that they're like underserved, you know, so there's just that kind of piece. But then when it comes down to it, the communities that we work with are like, well, whatever, like, we just want to make this thing happen. So it's, there's like, we're having these like high level like debates and spending all this time arguing about how, which I don't want to downplay the like importance of language, right? Language is very important, but it just goes to show that then when we are talking about affecting change, like the actual work, it's often, you know, a distraction, I would say, from doing the work. the other pieces that I find really hilarious every time we have new interns is the aha moment of, oh, well, I took a class on like how to do monitoring and evaluation or like project management. And now I see it in practice and it's so different. You can't follow the steps in this order. Like things, curveballs happen and like this is the actual like application or this is why it's important to be nimble and not so rigid in terms of like the frameworks that you use. And that's something that I really love about the like agile model or methodology that Alex was talking about. It's so like dynamic and it's about play. It's about remaining flexible and responsive. And I just think that that's the, like one of the biggest skills that you need to have more than any type of like specific field of study or certification. But yeah, I could go on. There are a number of things and want to give Alex a chance to answer as well.
I'm trying to think how to be succinct because you're taking us down a path that will really get me going. For me, the biggest question and that I try to answer or like just act framed from that based on that question is how do we transcend the illusion of separation? For me, there's nothing, it doesn't get more real than that. And also what, like questions that go along with that is how do I deconstruct the identity that society has conditioned me to believe that I am? What makes a life worth living? Truly worth living? And what's, if there's a universal answer to this, what conditions allow for the most like maximum well-being possible in community and in individuals in the context of this modern crazy society that we live in? Those would be the questions that like really get me. Yeah, fire me up, and that the work that I do and every day with Libraries Without Borders and beyond, that informed the work that I do.
Yeah, those are real questions. I see people nodding and being like, "Yeah, exactly. I've been thinking about that as well." But those are profound, real philosophical questions that also are really concrete. Yeah, thank you for that.
Right. And you touch on a point, like it don't make sense if it stays in the philosophical conceptual. Like I'm talking about how do we in action transcend the illusion of separation? Like how do I carry myself? How do I talk to people? What do I employ my vital energy in on a daily basis? And how does that reflect that I'm stuck in this personality that people have taught me that I am? And these roles, like infinite roles of like, I'm a teacher or I'm a accountant or whatever it is, right?
I want to open up totally to student contributions or maybe riffing off the ideas that are being thrown out here. Also, welcome to keep asking practical questions or concrete ones if you want to clarify things. But there's two in the chat already, so I'll highlight those. Alyssa. Where'd it go? Oh, there's a few. Oh my gosh. So, Alyssa had asked, was there a moment during your work that made you think I made a difference? If so, what was that moment? There's a question from Valerie, kind of similar, it sounds like. What's been the most rewarding part about doing this work? Libraries Without Borders. Oh, and a third, if you can handle that, if you can juggle these three. I'll give you an award. The third question is, what's a life lesson that you've learned during your work? Let's do a round and see which of those you'd like to speak to.
I want to start with the last one. I see the possibility. It's like a dream job I see the possibility of actually pulling down from the world of the realm of ideas and like dreams and visions, concrete results that will have impact on the lives and the well-being of people in Loíza, in this like particular community. And that feels super rewarding, that I could gift my talents and knowledge to making that possible. And they're providing the resources and the connections and the partners. And that's just like, wait, what? Really? When Moreno told me about it, I was like, oh, awesome. A moment when I felt that I really made a difference is when I closed a project when I was working with FEMA, where I basically, with another guy, managed medical equipment, life-saving equipment distribution project throughout pretty much all the municipalities of Puerto Rico. And I firsthand, over a couple of months, delivered 40,000 pieces of medical equipment to people that were bedridden or with some like discapacity or something. And that after that, my work was like administrative. Like once that project was gone and they wanted me to do like email stuff, that's meaningless work for me. But that was like made it really meaningful. And the third question, I lost it.
Sort of similar, maybe you hit on
it. Oh, the life lesson.
Life lesson.
The life lesson. I'm still taking the course.
I can jump in. The work that made me feel like I made a difference, I'm just going to double down on what I said earlier, that moment when we got the NSF grant, and it was just so like reaffirming to hear, okay, like all of the relationships that you've built and like the struggle to keep something going and support like the folks that I met in 2018, like Moreno, and the folks he introduced me to, that all of that, you know, was for something, and that we were laying the groundwork to build something bigger, right? That would just outlive what even like original vision we had for setting up connectivity in one community center, through Wi-Fi hotspots, to like setting up mesh networks, to like using these as, again, a stepping stone for what Alex mentioned earlier, the Barrios Ágiles, model. That was the moment where I just felt like, wow, this is happening. Like we're hiring people. We're revamping spaces. We're meeting, like Moreno's getting meetings with the mayor, like all, you know, and it's turning into this whole thing. The Mellon Foundation wants to talk to us and like maybe support us for many years from now on. Like that was just like, yeah. And having a conversation also with like the Mellon Foundation, and having them also just like smiling from ear to ear as I'm telling them, oh no, like we've been talking to this person since this year. And oh, that person, like, yeah, we work with them, you know, just like being able to speak from a place of like authenticity, in terms of we're not BSing like what we're saying we're doing. And we're also like, I was pretty transparent. Like these have been the struggles, like, and having them just say, oh, you know what you're talking about, like we want to invite you to apply for this thing and give you more money and like support this work further. So that also was the life lesson for me, which was don't give in to the pressure to conform, because I think there were a lot of foundations, a lot of government agencies that also wanted like a very specific type of project, and they wanted to support very discrete aspects of a project that may or may not have been related to the actual needs of folks in the communities where we were working. So I learned that you shouldn't like just try to make yourself fit into something because you want to get some money to make your project like come to life, that it's important to speak from a place of authenticity, where you're rooted in the reality, and not misrepresent what's happening. So those were like biggest lessons, most rewarding, and moment like I felt like I made a difference.
Awesome.
I want to jump in to share like an actual lesson.
Oh, yeah.
Which is that in our modern society, we got the hierarchy of mind, body, heart wrong. Mind is fully based on our experiences here on the world of matter, right? But heart and intuition, the information that comes from there doesn't come from this realm, comes beyond time and space. I have personally, my experience, like, tested this time and again. And when we learn to exercise that intelligence and we let ourselves be guided by it, we also understand that there's nothing random. And then we could put ourselves in the service of whatever it is that's coming through, informing our direction. And in a very, like, I'm trying to really, like, make this very practical, like, just be able, make it teachable, because it is. But we got it all wrong, like, mind, brain, intellectual doesn't have a superior spot in the hierarchy of things, in my experience, and that's one of the biggest lessons. And once we tap into that, we can really get going on our path, and we all have our own curriculum.
I didn't think we'd have a presentation on some NGO work, and then we're also questioning the Cartesian subject. We're speaking really, yeah, on many levels. I want to open up to any other questions or comments from students in the room. I know people had dropped it in the chat because we were, you know, talking. Folks, have any other things we'd like to hear about? Or connections that, you know, you're thinking on the top of your head, connections to your own experience or questions you're grappling with right now? Okay, cool. Well, I really thank y'all for coming and speaking with us and just taking the time to talk on all these different themes.
Again, thank you for the opportunity. And if folks are interested in learning more, please, Elliot, feel free to share my contact info. I won't volunteer you, Alex, but yeah, he's in agreement. You can, share our emails, and I'd be happy. I'm sure Alex would be too, to, you know, expand on anything we discussed or answer any new questions that come up.